We have with us live in the studios once again, Maria Tomczyk with Eat the Steak. Good morning.
Good morning.
All right. Lots to cover today, starting with a new interim SPD chief.
Yeah, our new mayor, Ed Murray, appointed a new interim SPD chief for the Seattle Police Department. Interim Chief Jim Pugel decided to step down. That was how Murray framed it, because Pugel expressed an interest in the permanent job of being chief of the Seattle Police Department. And then Murray said, well, you know, and rather than having someone who is interested in being the permanent chief run the department while we're doing the search, we're going to avoid any potential conflicts of interest and appoint a separate interim chief, which was kind of interesting because, you know, during the last search for a chief for the SPD, the interim chief was Diaz, who was eventually selected the permanent chief. And that made me sort of wonder if Murray was taking a slam at his predecessor and saying, well, this is what McGinn should have done when they were searching for a permanent chief last time, is he should have made Diaz step down rather than let him influence the search process or let him influence the decision of the search committee or of the city council and the mayor at that time, which I thought was kind of interesting. So the new interim chief is Henry Bailey. He's a retired former Seattle Police Department officer of 35 years experience from 1972 to 2007. Bailey's an African American. He is clearly meant to appeal to the minority communities in Seattle who have been very unhappy with the performance of the Seattle Police Department, particularly in terms of police harassment and the former mayor used to call the perception of biased policing, but which of course the Department of Justice included in their report as a troubling trend. Bailey may or may not do a better job at police reform than Jim Pugel did. Pugel did, I think, a pretty good job to try to push that forward. And we don't know what Bailey is going to do or whether he's going to be able to make more of an impact than Pugel, because you really have to ask the question, who's responsible for the lack of reform, given that the report that was issued in December by the court-appointed monitor of the Department of Justice agreement for reform in the Seattle Police Department was very, very critical of Seattle Police Department management. You have to ask that question, well, really, who among the SPD management was responsible for the lack of reform? Now, Pugel recently, after that report was issued in December, he forced out two of his assistant chiefs. You know, there's four assistant chiefs there at the SPD, and there's two additional ones, Clark Kimmerer and Mike Sanford. And at the press conference this week, when reporters asked Mayor Murray, you know, because really, if you think about it, the buck stops with the mayor when it comes to reform at the police department. When reporters asked him, well, are you going to replace those two other assistant police chiefs? He refused to answer that question, saying that personnel issues would be the province of the new interim chief. Well, we'll see. excuse me. But in particular, you know, you have to point out it was the management staff that were highly criticized by the SPD monitor. So, you know, is Murray taking that to mean the interim chief Pugel didn't do quite as good a job as he should have, or is this his way of saying, I'll bring in a new guy and the new guy can bring in his new assistants and then it'll look less like the mayor cracking down on the SPD. So we'll see where that goes. In the meantime, Murray also announced this week that he was putting together two separate committees to do the search for a new SPD chief. Now, last time there was one big committee of city staffers and community and business leaders and activists. This time, Murray split that big committee into two groups. One of the groups is going to be a lean 12-member search committee that includes people like Tim Burgess, who is the new city council president, and Bruce Harrell, who will probably retain his position on the city council as head of the committee that oversees the police department. Sue Rauer, who is a former King County sheriff and now runs the State Police Academy, and Ron Smith, who is an SPD officer who is expected to be the new head of the Police Officers Guild there, are going to be sitting on that 12-member search committee. Now, that 12-member search committee is going to do the hard work of tracking down the hard and what I would say core work of tracking down candidates, interviewing them, researching their backgrounds, and eventually recommending three candidates to the city council and the mayor. The second committee that Mayor Murray announced is a bigger 35-person advisory committee, which will take testimony from the public, put together recommendations, and tell the 12-member search committee what kind of qualities they want in a candidate for the Seattle Police Department chief. And what I find kind of interesting in this is that, of course, this is going to speed up the search process for sure. But on the other hand, it also appears to be a really great way to sideline public concerns about who is going to be the new police chief. It's really a great way to say, well, you know, we're gonna sidestep the usual Seattle process in order to get this done and get this done quickly. Well, the usual Seattle process involves a lot of input from the public and ultimately coming up with candidates who address public concerns. And the fact that Murray has divided the search process into two and put the public comments over here, you know, said, okay, well, we'll just sort of pay lip service to public comment. That's very troubling.
Wow, 35-member committee is just enormous.
It is big. Yeah, both committees are going to be co-chaired by two people, former King County Executive Ron Sims and immigration rights activist Pramila Jayapal is going to be the other co-chair. Mm. The advisory committee is going to be holding four town hall events between January 28th and February 1st, so, you know, four events in just a couple days, which shows you how quickly they're pushing forward on this search process. The place and time is going to be announced in the future.
All right. Anything else on that? Let's move on to Mayor Murray's giving a pay raise.
Yeah, Mayor Murray announced this week that he was going to raise the pay for city employees to $15 an hour, and that there's about 600 city employees who are paid less than that. That's going to increase the city budget by about $700,000. Seems like a lot, but in the overall city budget, it's not a big chunk of money. On the other hand, there's been some back and forth this week between the mayor and new city council member Shama Sawant over the $15 an hour minimum wage in the city of Seattle for all city of Seattle workers. Shama Sawant is pushing forward in supporting a group to push for an initiative if the city council and the mayor don't move quickly on the $15 an hour minimum wage proposal. Mayor Ed Murray has been throwing a few comments towards Shama Sawant, saying, you know, she should slow down and be part of the Seattle process. I guess the Seattle process is important when it comes to things like the $15 an hour minimum wage. It's not so important when it comes to selecting a new SPD chief.
All right. Moving on to the state and transportation funding.
Yeah, state legislators are getting ready for the new legislative session, which is going to start on Monday. And, of course, one of the big things that they didn't get done in the last legislative session last year in 2013 was a transportation budget. And, you know, the state legislature had how many sessions? Four sessions, I think, last year, the main session and then three emergency sessions afterwards. And in each of those emergency sessions, one of the things that they fought over, Democrats and Republicans, the House, which is controlled by Democrats, and the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans, the Republican minority plus two turncoat Democrats who decided to side with the Republicans and form a Republican-based majority, they fought over a transportation budget. And of course, all throughout 2013, they didn't come up with any good transportation budget for the state of Washington. Now, the Joint Transportation Committee met in Olympia this week, and on Tuesday, they took testimony from State Transportation Secretary Lynn Peterson. She gave a 20-minute presentation, but didn't stick around for a question-and-answer session, which I think is kind of interesting. One of the main pieces of her presentation was a discussion of the 520 bridge, and she admitted that the 520 bridge is over budget by about $420 million. That's almost half a billion dollars. That means that they will need an extra $170 million over their reserves. So the reserves have been spent, in other words, or they're looking at the reserves being completely spent on construction delays and the cracked pontoons. And they're going to need an additional $170 million to be drawn from somewhere in the current transportation budget. That means, of course, they're going to be taking the money probably from other transportation projects, or they're going to need to raise taxes in some way to make up that difference. Now, that's just for the first phase of the 520 bridge. That's constructing the span that goes across Lake Washington. That's about half of the construction that needs to be done for the complete 520 floating bridge. The other portion is the Montlake Portage Bay portion. That's another $1.5 billion. Most of that money hasn't even been found yet. You know, they're saying, well, you know, that's phase two. We'll find the funding when we get to it. Well, yeah, where's that money going to come from is the big question. So on top of that $1.5 billion that hasn't been found, and some people would argue it's really $2 billion, there's an extra now $170 million that has to be found from somewhere. Now, Peterson also said that there are problems with the tunnel, and the transportation committee held a press conference later in the week on Thursday, where they admitted that cost overruns on the 520 bridge and delays on the tunnel, particularly with the fact that the Big Bertha drilling machine has sat idle for about a month now, more than a month now, is going to make it really hard to reach an agreement in Olympia this session between the Democrats and the Republicans on a new transportation bill. So, you know, they couldn't agree last year when they didn't have these problems. And now they're saying prior to the legislative session that, yeah, these big cost overruns now on these big projects are going to make it even harder to come up with a transportation budget. Makes me want to kind of go down there, take some Republicans aside and say, look, you're not doing your job. This is a big piece of your job. You have to get this done. And we'll see if they can actually do it. I doubt that they will. Of course, it was very easy in an emergency session at the end of last year to set aside $9 billion for Boeing, who is now going to stay in the state of Washington and take advantage of those $9 billion in tax cuts, which could have gone into funding a $10 billion transportation package.
Oh, well.
Oh, well. The things we miss out on.
Moving on, the Supreme Court and McCleary.
Yeah, the state Supreme Court ruled this week on McCleary. That's the case that was brought in 2012 by students, parents, and teachers and school districts in the state of Washington that had to do with adequate funding of public education in Washington state. Now, the court ruled in 2012 that the state was mandated by the state constitution to fully fund basic education, and that state government was falling far short of that goal, that state government was going to have to put several billion dollars. The closest estimate, the most reasonable estimate I saw was about $6 billion into basic K-12 education in the state of Washington between 2012, when the ruling was passed, when the ruling was made by the state Supreme Court, and about mid-2017, over the course of about 4 years. Now, last year, that means, of course, last year, the state legislature was supposed to come up with an additional about $2 billion as a good down payment to make up for that big funding gap. would have gotten it going in the 2013-14 biennium by putting about $2 billion into it. The state legislature, on the other hand, came up with a budget that only put just under $1 billion into basic K through 12 education. And this week, the Supreme Court said that, well, that's only about a 6.7% increase in education funding, and that's not sufficient. The state legislature has to come up with a plan and has to do it soon to speed up the plugging that funding gap. Otherwise, the court is going to hold the state legislature in contempt. Now, I'm not sure what kind of penalties would come from that, but it would not be pretty. It would not be a good thing. Now, the state, when you've got the state legislature unable to come up with a transportation budget and barely able to have passed an operating budget last year, I don't know what they're going to be able to do in order to fill this gap. My guess is that they're not going to want to. State Superintendent Randy Dorn says that he is recommending to the state legislature a 1% increase in the sales tax and an increase in the property tax to try to bring in more funding for public education. The Supreme Court is saying that in spite of the Republicans in the state legislature saying that a tax increase is not possible, that the state legislature has to come up with a funding plan. And that's going to mean either some kind of tax increase or some kind of closing of tax loopholes. And that's what Governor Inslee is proposing, that some state tax exemptions be ended.
All right. Moving on. Goldman Sachs selling its shares in SSA Marine.
Yeah, the news hit this week that Goldman Sachs has sold its share in SSA Marine, which made them a major partner in construction of the Cherry Point coal terminal near Bellingham. But I just want to say that this is a big part of Goldman Sachs' overall strategy to divest from the coal industry altogether, because they see environmental problems as a big barrier to making coal profitable in the United States. Also, I should point out, too, Goldman Sachs is a financial services company based here in the United States, and so they are susceptible to public perception of their business here within the United States. On the other hand, while some environmental groups say this is a big victory, on the other hand, Goldman Sachs sold their interests back to the original owners of SSA Marine, who then sold that interest to a foreign investor, a wealthy Mexican businessman. And when you have a foreign investor picking up that interest in SSA Marine and getting involved in a big project like this, that foreign investor is not vulnerable to U.S. public opinion. He could care less, really, what Americans think of him and his companies and his business practices. So it may make it even harder to get SSA Marine to give up the Cherry Point terminal due to public pressure if you have a foreign investor owning a controlling share in one of the major developers. So that isn't necessarily a victory for the folks who are opposing and I'm included in that, the folks who oppose the coal terminal at Cherry Point.
All right. On to national and Congress millionaires.
Yeah, a study of public disclosure reports by congressional members shows now for the first time in history that half of all Congress members are millionaires. The median net worth of members of Congress now has topped $1 million. It's $1,008,767. Democrats and Republicans are about equal in that share. For Democrats, the median net worth is about $1.04 million. For Republicans, it's about just a little over a million. And also this week, we saw a different million figure. We saw that over 1 million Americans lost their unemployment benefits because that the millionaires in Congress have refused to pass an extension of unemployment benefits for folks who have been long-term unemployed in this economic environment where we have official unemployment at 7%. Now, this doesn't count, of course, people who have been kicked off of unemployment insurance and the folks who have given up trying to look for a job. The real unemployment figure would be closer to double digits, probably closer to 20%, is my guess. In the United States, 20% is one in five people. So Congress saying that we like to take home $1 million a year or more. Some members of Congress take home hundreds of millions of dollars every year, but we can't lend a helping hand to folks who are struggling to find a job in this economy. That's pretty savage, in my opinion.
All right. And on to other economic news this week.
Yeah, different economic news. This a little bit better. There was only a modest rise in healthcare costs. Now, by modest, what that means, according to American economists, is that healthcare spending increased only 3.7% this year. That's a little bit under double the inflation rate. And that's considered a modest increase versus the double-digit increases in healthcare spending that we've seen over the past couple of decades. Now, as a share of the economy, healthcare spending is about 17.2%. That's a lot, if you really think about it. Now, some folks say it's because of the economic downturn, and others in the Obama administration, in particular, say that it's the effect of the Affordable Care Act kicking in. So we can ask the question, is it one or is it the other? By 2012, the economy really was starting to improve some. So you could argue, and insurance companies at the same time were increasing their premium rates quite a bit in order to make up for what they saw as limits on increases that they were going to be able to put on their premiums under the Affordable Care Act. So just before the Affordable Care Act kicked in, they wanted to get big increase in their premiums in there. So you could argue that healthcare spending should have shot up a lot and that the Affordable Care Act actually had a bigger impact than people are giving it credit for. If you look at the details, it gives us some more clues about that too. Spending for drugs, for example, only increased by about 0.4% because a lot of the big brand name drugs went off patent, drugs like Lipitor, Plavix, and Singulair. And the big pharmaceutical companies really didn't have any new drugs to bring onto the market. And the fact that that had a big impact on overall healthcare spending shows you the impact that the private pharmaceutical industry has on overall healthcare spending in the United States. But that wasn't the only determining factor. Other expenses were not so high, too. Hospital visits only increased by about 4.9%, expenses on doctor bills increased only 4.6%. Well, you could argue people are going to the doctor less because they don't have the money for the copay or they don't have the money to pay the doctor. Well, yes, if that were the case, though, you would see expenses on hospital visits go up because when people don't go see the doctor to take care of small health problems, they tend to become bigger health problems and they end up going to the hospital. Well, that's not what we saw. So I would agree with folks who think that the Affordable Care Act really is a part of the equation when it comes to moderating healthcare costs.
All right, minimum wage poll.
Yeah, Quinnipiac University did a poll on attitudes towards the minimum wage, and what they found is that 71% of Americans support raising the minimum wage. Not everyone, of course, could agree on how high to raise the minimum wage. About 33% like President Obama's suggested amount of $10.10 per hour. My guess is they like it because they've heard of it. And about equal numbers wanted to raise the minimum wage. About 18 to 20% wanted to raise it more than that. About 18 to 20% less than that. So my guess is that the way the poll was phrased made a big difference in people's responses, and that if the dominant discussion at the national level were for a $15 minimum wage rather than the $10.10 per hour that Obama has thrown out there, that attitudes would be different in terms of raising it to a higher rate.
All right. Marijuana sales.
Yeah, Colorado had its first week of recreational marijuana sales with the opening of 37 dispensaries in the state of Colorado. Huffington Post did an interesting survey where they called those 37 dispensaries and asked them how much in sales they had in their first week. And they came up with a figure of $5 million in total sales of marijuana, recreational marijuana in Colorado in the first week. Now, the state has projected about $600 million per year in sales of recreational marijuana annually, and they expect that they would be able to collect about $70 million in taxes per year on that amount. So that gives us some idea of what the state of Washington could see in terms of revenue for our recreational marijuana industry once we actually get our dispensaries open. Now, the target, as far as I can tell, is June, but there's no set date yet for when dispensaries will open in the state of Washington.
All right. Iraq and Syria.
Yeah, a new Islamic state of Iraq and Syria with the group with the Al-Qaeda-affiliated group of that name having taken over the city of the town of Fallujah and much of the city of Ramadi in Anbar province in Iraq, and also now controlling a large portion of northwest Syria. We can truly say that there probably is now an Islamic state of Iraq and Syria. That this is not should not be a surprise to anyone with the ongoing civil war in Iraq. And the fact that we could have predicted this when the U.S. first invaded Iraq back in 2003, that this was going to happen eventually. And, of course, now it really has happened. The U.S., of course, is rushing missiles and planes to Iraq to try to reverse this trend. But it's too late. And, of course, it's not something that's that long term is going to be reversible, I think.
All right. Events.
Also, let's see, the events this week we have on Sunday, January 12th at 2:30 p.m., a $15 minimum wage kickoff rally at the Labor Temple at 2800 First Avenue at Broad Street in Belltown. On Thursday, January 16th, noon to 2, is a community forum on public transportation sponsored by SCCC and Seattle Transit Writers Union. That's at the Broadway Performance Hall at Broadway and Pine on the Seattle Central Community College campus. On also on Thursday, January 16th, at the Common Good Cafe at 7 p.m., to honor MLK is to act for justice. It's a discussion and panel with Mary Patterson and Lino Magdaleno of the Seattle Human Rights Commission at the University Temple United Methodist Church at 15th and Northeast 43rd in the U District.
All right. Talking with Maria Tomchik with Eat the State, and where do people find Eat the State?
Eat the State can be found online at www.eatthestate.org.